Imagine opening your banking app on payday, and right next to your balance is a little red countdown timer.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's an unsettling thought.
Right. And it says you have exactly 30 days to spend your paycheck, or the money simply, poof, it vanishes from your account.
Just gone.
Completely gone. I mean, it sounds like a dystopian sci-fi novel, but the underlying software architecture for exactly that kind of, you know, programmable money is actively being built right now by central banks all around the world.
It really is. And it fundamentally changes the definition of what money actually is. You know, like we are rapidly transitioning away from a bearer instrument.
A bearer instrument, meaning like physical cash.
Exactly. Where holding a physical $20 bill means you possess absolute unquestionable purchasing power. We're moving from that into a system of, well, programmable networks. Networks where access to purchasing power can be conditionally granted, monitored, or even revoked by whoever controls the ledger.
And that transition is exactly what we are dissecting today.
Welcome to this deep dive, everyone. We are looking through a massive stack of material today. We've got financial analysis briefings, recent political speeches, macroeconomic policy papers, and it's all centering on one monumental shift.
The digital currency revolution.
The digital currency revolution, exactly. So the mission for this deep dive is pretty clear. First, we're going to explore the massive, tangible positives, you know, the promises of these new technologies like stablecoins and central bank digital currencies or CBDCs.
Right. And there are some really huge positives. We're talking unprecedented payment efficiency, open financial standards, and how nations are using this tech to secure their monetary sovereignty.
Right. The foundational building blocks of a modernized global economy. But then we have to flip the coin and unpack the dark side. Because, man, the material we're looking at lays out some incredibly severe negatives.
Yeah, it gets pretty dark. It does. We are talking about the architecture for total state surveillance, staggering political conflicts of interest, and this deeply concerning concept of mission creep. So, okay, let's unpack this, starting with how the historically volatile crypto market is suddenly pouring some very heavy cement foundations.
Yeah, that transition from speculation to infrastructure is, like, the key theme in the recent legislative push. For years, the broader cryptocurrency space operated with systemic fragility, just wild swings.
The Wild West, basically.
Totally. But if we look at the recent policy shifts in the U.S., what the financial sector dubbed Crypto Week, we are seeing a massive coordinated effort to institutionalize the space.
And the centerpiece of that being the Genius Act, right?
Right, the Genius Act.
So since stablecoins are explicitly designed to maintain a strict one-to-one peg with the U.S. dollar, the Genius Act is now demanding that issuers actually hold those reserves in a highly regulated manner. I mean, you have to back every single digital dollar on the ledger with an actual dollar in a vault or with like ultra-safe short-term government bonds.
Which mathematically alters the risk profile of the entire asset class. If we look at the mechanics of past crypto collapses, like the Terra Luna disaster, for example.
Oh, yeah, that algorithmic stablecoin mess.
Exactly. They failed because the peg was maintained by speculative financial engineering. When the confidence vanished, the algorithmic backing just collapsed.
Triggering a classic bank run.
Right. But by legally mandating a one-to-one backing with zero duration risk, meaning short-term treasury bills rather than long-term risky loans, the Genius Act effectively neutralizes that bank run mechanism.
It basically eliminates the fake money aspect of it.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. And by removing that existential risk, the sector instantly gains the credibility required for traditional banks, massive asset managers, and institutional investors to finally plug their infrastructure into these digital networks. It moves stablecoins out of the decentralized casino and, well, into the realm of core financial plumbing.
And the corporate world is moving in aggressively, like really fast. The briefings detail a new project called OpenUSD. It's this stablecoin initiative backed by an alliance of 140 massive tech and finance companies.
Heavy hitters.
Yeah, we are talking Visa, Stripe, MasterCard, BlackRock, Google, Coinbase. They've all teamed up to build a single standard. But here's what I don't fully grasp.
Yeah.
Historically, the business model for a stablecoin issuer is that you take $1 billion in customer deposits, you buy treasury bonds, and you keep the like 4 or 5% yield for yourself.
Right. It's an incredibly lucrative money printer.
It is. So why on earth is OpenUSD completely flipping that script? Why give that up?
Because they recognize that network effects are ultimately more valuable than immediate yield extraction. OpenUSD strategy is to eliminate creation and redemption fees entirely.
Wait, really? No fees at all?
None. Instead of hoarding the interest generated by those underlying treasury bonds, they plan to redistribute that yield back to the developers, the merchants, and the liquidity providers who are actually building the ecosystem.
Oh, wow. So they are essentially subsidizing the adoption of their own network.
Exactly.
So is this basically what HTTP did for the internet, but like applied to the velocity of money? Creating an open shared protocol where everyone benefits from the interoperability rather than one company trying to own a closed off toll booth.
That is an excellent way to frame it. HTTP allowed different computer networks to seamlessly communicate, right? OpenUSD aims to be the interoperability layer for capital.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah. If you create a standard that is universally beneficial and frictionless, the adoption becomes organic. You achieve instant transfers across the globe 24/7 with almost zero reliance on the slow batch processing architecture of traditional correspondent banking.
And the efficiency gains there are just massive. I mean, the sources point out Stripe is already moving to make it their default settlement layer. But that efficiency isn't just a corporate luxury, is it?
Not at all.
Because on a global scale, whoever controls that instant, internet native money controls the underlying financial infrastructure. And that is exactly why Europe is suddenly terrified of being left behind by American payment giants. Like, we have to move from corporate efficiency to national survival here.
We do, because infrastructure is indistinguishable from geopolitical power. And right now, the European Central Bank is looking at their payment networks and realizing how incredibly vulnerable they are to external leverage.
Enter the digital euro. The policy papers outline the ECB's target for a 2028 rollout. And looking at the mechanics of this, it isn't just about offering citizens a cool new payment app on their phone. This is fundamentally a defense play.
Absolutely a defense play. Think about it. When a consumer taps their bank card to buy a coffee in Paris or Berlin or Rome, the data and the clearing process for that transaction are almost certainly routing through American payment rails.
Specifically Visa or MasterCard.
Exactly. So Europe wants to drastically reduce its dependency on foreign infrastructure. The digital euro is designed to act as a sovereign public utility. It's a direct complement to physical cash, guaranteed one-to-one by the central bank itself.
And it even incorporates offline transaction capabilities, right?
Yes, which is huge. It means if the internet goes down, or if a foreign power attempts to cut off European access to international payment networks, the domestic economy can still function.
Which is brilliant.
Yeah.
But zooming out even further to the macroeconomic chessboard, the U.S. and Europe aren't just competing with each other. The ultimate showdown highlighted in the geopolitical analysis is the U.S. versus China.
Oh, yeah. It is the battle for the reserve currency of the 21st century. And mechanically speaking, China is significantly further along in this race.
They officially rolled out their CDDC, the digital yuan or ECNY, back in 2022, didn't they?
They did. But their ambition isn't limited to just domestic retail payments. They are aggressively integrating this digital financial infrastructure into their Belt and Road Initiative, which, you know, now involves over 150 countries.
That is wild. They are literally laying down the physical infrastructure, the ports, highways, telecom towers, and then layering their sovereign digital payment rails right on top of it.
It's a complete package.
But for the listener, how does that actually challenge the U.S. dollar globally?
Well, to understand that, we really have to look at the mechanics of SWIFT. SWIFT is often misunderstood as a bank, but it's actually just a highly secure messaging system.
Like a texting network for banks.
Exactly. It's how international banks text each other to say, you know, debit this account in London, credit this account in Tokyo. Because the U.S. financial system has overwhelming influence over that messaging network, the U.S. can enforce global sanctions by essentially turning off a country's phone service.
Right. And if you're kicked off SWIFT, you cannot participate in global dollar trade.
Right. So China's response with the digital yuan isn't just a new currency. It's a new communications protocol altogether.
Ah, I see.
Yeah. China is building an entirely independent alternative called CyPS, the Cross-Border Interbank Payment System. By routing digital yuan transactions through SIPS, they create a parallel cellular network. It allows them to trade, settle debts, and exert economic influence globally without the transaction ever passing through U.S. monitored infrastructure.
Wow. So the U.S. literally cannot see the text message, which means the U.S. cannot sanction the transaction.
Exactly. It bypasses the control mechanism completely.
Which brings us to how the United States is actually responding to this threat.
Mm.
And the strategy outlined in the analysis is, I gotta say, it's brilliant in its pragmatism. The U.S. response isn't to force the Federal Reserve to build a better, faster digital dollar. The response is to deploy a Trojan horse.
A decentralized vanguard for the dollar.
Right. By establishing clear regulatory frameworks like the Genius Act, the U.S. is allowing privately issued stablecoins to run free on global crypto rails. So if a merchant in Argentina or a contractor in Nigeria wants a stable store of value to protect against local inflation, they don't have to navigate the friction of opening a clunky, heavily restricted American bank account.
No, they simply download a digital wallet and acquire a U.S. dollar-backed stablecoin.
It organically expands the hegemony of the U.S. dollar to places traditional banking architecture could never reach. The U.S. government just lets private tech companies foot the bill for building the fast, interoperable rails, while the underlying asset, the U.S. dollar, maintains its global dominance as the ultimate unit of account.
It's outsourcing the infrastructure costs while keeping the geopolitical benefits.
Okay, so we've clearly established that these digital tools are geopolitically massive. I mean, they are the mechanisms that will secure or dismantle economic empires. But that sheer level of power means we have to look closely at who is actually pulling the levers. We need to transition from the macroeconomic theories into the messy, highly consequential reality of the political figures drafting these rules.
Which brings us to the intersection of regulatory power and personal financial incentive.
Yeah. And before we get into this next section, I want to be super clear with you, the listener. The analysis we are examining contains some highly politically charged data regarding both left-wing and right-wing figures. We are not taking sides, and we are not endorsing these viewpoints. We are strictly imparting the facts, figures, and structural risks exactly as they are presented in the original source material.
It is a critical disclaimer, really, because the scale of the financial conflicts detailed in the reports is unprecedented.
It really is. So let's look at the specific data points the briefings highlight regarding Donald Trump.
Mm.
During the exact same crypto week where he was publicly championing pro-crypto legislation and promising favorable regulatory environments, his own family's business empire was actively transforming into a digital money machine.
Right. The timeline and the capital inflows are the core focus of the conflict of interest analysis here.
The numbers are staggering. The data tracks that his son made roughly $1 billion in just 9 months through trading meme coins and various decentralized crypto projects.
A billion. In 9 months.
Yeah. Furthermore, the family has direct, formalized ties to a decentralized finance platform called World Liberty Financial, which is launching its own proprietary token and stablecoin. The analysis estimates that Trump's personal net worth grew by $620 million from these digital operations in a matter of months.
And that's not even counting foreign investment.
Right. On top of that, Sovereign Wealth from Abu Dhabi has allegedly pledged $2 billion in investments linked directly to that new token ecosystem.
Yeah. And when you look at those mechanics, it raises a profoundly important question about regulatory capture. We are at a critical juncture where the global economy desperately needs neutral, rigorously stress-tested financial regulation.
Right.
But if the political figures drafting the rulebook for decentralized finance are simultaneously extracting hundreds of millions or billions of dollars through those exact same deregulated channels, well, it fundamentally compromises the integrity of the system.
It's like having the head referee of the Super Bowl actively placing massive prop bets on the game while simultaneously rewriting the rules for a first down at halftime.
Yeah.
Like, you just can't trust the outcome of the game.
That is the exact systemic risk.
Yeah.
Are we actually building a free, robust, decentralized financial system designed to outcompete China? Or, as the analysis questions, are we just inflating a massive politically protected business venture disguised as financial freedom?
And traditional commercial banks are watching this dynamic with deep alarm, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Because if regulators are personally incentivized to let stablecoin issuers operate with massive advantages, it could rapidly drain billions in deposits out of the heavily regulated traditional banking sector and straight into these lightly regulated digital wallets.
So the risk of staggering personal enrichment by politicians manipulating the rules is a massive negative. But according to the deeper macroeconomic breakdowns, the potential for absolute state control through central bank digital currencies is an even greater systemic threat. Let's look at the ultimate negative, the architecture of the surveillance state.
Yeah, to grasp the severity of this, we really need to clearly contrast the underlying architecture of something like Bitcoin with a CBDC, because while both use digital ledgers, their power dynamics are completely inverted.
Help break that down for us.
So Bitcoin's ledger is public, but its consensus mechanism is decentralized across thousands of independent nodes. No one entity controls it. A CBDC, however, is a centralized permissioned ledger.
Meaning the central bank, and by extension, the government maintains a direct, unblinking view of every single node and every single transaction.
Every cup of coffee, every charitable donation, every medical expense. Because the ledger is centralized, the state possesses perfect granular visibility into the economic behavior of every citizen in real time.
Man, and the political pushback against that specific architecture is already happening. The legislative briefs cover a piece of U.S. legislation called the CBDC Anti-Surveillance State Act. It narrowly passed the House 2-19-2-17. It explicitly mandates that the Federal Reserve cannot issue a retail digital dollar without direct, explicit congressional authorization.
Right. The legislative intent there is to legally block the executive branch or the central bank from quietly installing a financial surveillance tool under the benign guise of a simple, you know, technological upgrade.
And we're seeing this at the state level, too. The data highlights Florida Governor Ron DeSantis proactively banning the use of CBDCs within his state's borders. He framed the technology as a tool for economic central planners to dictate daily life. He is positioning it as a preemptive strike against algorithmic government overreach.
And that precise fear of central planning is the greatest hurdle the European Central Bank faces as they attempt to sell the digital euro to the public.
Right, because the ECB is aggressively promising the exact opposite. They swear that the digital euro will be fully compliant with GDPR privacy laws. They explicitly state it will not be programmable money.
Meaning no expiration dates.
Right, meaning the central bank won't attach expiration dates to your funds, and they won't dictate which merchants you're allowed to transact with. It is pitched as a purely neutral utility.
Well, that is the architectural blueprint currently written on paper.
But wait, if the ECB is writing strict GDPR privacy protections into the digital euro today, how do we get from a harmless payment app to a dystopian surveillance state? Like, what is the actual mechanism for that shift? Aren't those just promises written on paper? What stops them from changing the rules?
This raises an important question, and it is perhaps the most critical insight from the entire stack of sources. The mechanism for that shift is a well-documented phenomenon known as mission creep.
The gradual, incremental expansion of a project's authority beyond its original scope.
Exactly. Because a CBDC is fundamentally software, right? It's an API for fiat currency. The rules governing it are just code.
Right.
So today, the code dictates that the digital euro is neutral. But tomorrow, a crisis emerges. It could be a sudden geopolitical conflict, a severe push for anti-money laundering compliance, or, say, a climate emergency. Under the pressure of a crisis, a small legislative amendment is passed. The code is updated. The privacy guarantees thin out.
You just write a new if-then statement into the money itself?
Precisely. If the money is digital, centralized, and controlled by a single sovereign entity, it is programmable by default. The capability is baked into the technology, and the macroeconomic papers point out that China has already actively experimented with this.
They have.
Yeah. They have coded expiration dates into localized distributions of the digital yuan to aggressively stimulate economic activity.
Which brings us back to that terrifying countdown timer on your paycheck from the beginning of our deep dive. If the government decides inflation is too low, they literally force you to spend your savings by threatening to delete it.
It transforms money from a store value into a temporary license to consume. And the potential for social coercion is profound. A government could theoretically program the ledger to decline transactions at politically inconvenient merchants or block donations to opposition groups.
That's chilling.
The analysis even explores the theoretical integration of CBDCs with carbon tracking, tying your personal purchasing power directly to your CO2 emissions limit.
Oh, man. So if your digital wallet registers that you got too much gasoline this month, the central bank's API rejects your attempt to purchase a steak at the grocery store. I mean, it sounds hyperbolic, but the capability is right there in the code.
It is.
And interestingly, when confronted with these exact scenarios, ECB President Christine Lagarde publicly dismissed them as conspiracy theories. Yet, almost simultaneously, she conceded that there will be no true anonymity with the digital euro.
Which is the core contradiction right there. The technological architecture required for a seamless payment system is identical to the architecture required for total surveillance. The only thing separating the European model from the Chinese model is the current set of democratic guardrails. And as history consistently demonstrates, legal guardrails can be dismantled.
And we are already seeing strange artificial restrictions being hard-coded into the system from day one. The policy drafts reveal that the digital euro has a planned holding limit. A citizen will only be allowed to hold roughly 3,000 euros in their digital wallet at any given time. Like, why artificially cap how much of the government's money I can hold?
Yeah, because the mechanics of a CBDC present an existential threat to commercial banks.
How so?
Well, think about it. If you have 50,000 euros in a private commercial bank and a systemic financial crisis hits, you are going to panic. Historically, you would have to physically go to the bank and withdraw paper cash. But with a CBDC, you could open your app and transfer your entire life savings directly onto the central bank's ultra-safe ledger in 3 seconds.
Oh, wow. It enables a digital bank run at the speed of light.
Exactly. The liquidity would drain from the commercial banking sector instantaneously, causing a total collapse of the credit markets. So to protect the private banks, the central bank has to program a hard cap into the code, severely limiting your access to the safest form of digital money.
Okay, let's step back and look at the totality of what we've covered. We began this deep dive by exploring the truly revolutionary promises of digital architecture. Stablecoins utilizing one-to-one backing to build trust, corporate alliances like OpenUSD distributing yield to create frictionless, internet-native money, and governments leveraging digital infrastructure to defend their sovereign economies. It is a brilliant, necessary modernization of capital.
It really is. It's the inevitable evolution of how human beings transfer value over space and time.
But the shadow cast by this evolution is incredibly dark. We are staring down a system vulnerable to massive regulatory capture, where politicians rewrite the rules for networks they hold vast personal stakes in. And worse, we are building the ultimate infrastructure for state control, a centralized programmable ledger highly susceptible to mission creep, where the convenience of instant payments today slowly morphs into algorithmic behavioral control tomorrow.
The technology itself is completely agnostic. It will simply execute the instructions of whoever holds the cryptographic keys.
So I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over a question that naturally arises from the mechanics we've dissected today. If physical, untraceable cash is eventually phased out entirely, and every single transaction you make must pass through a digital network governed by politicians who possess the technological capability to program exactly what you're allowed to buy, and when you're allowed to buy it, do you actually own your money anymore? Or are you simply renting purchasing power from the state?
A profound and necessary question to consider as this architecture is built around us.
It really is. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the systems around you. Keep learning. And we will catch you next time.